Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first, we present There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a programme presented and produced by Jill Bevilacqua.
Pilate called together the chief priests, the ruling class, and the people, and said to them, "You have brought this man before me as one who subverts the people. I have examined him in your presence, and have no charge against him arising from your allegations. Neither has Herod, who therefore has sent him back to us. Obviously this man has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore I mean to release him, once I have taught him a lesson." The whole crowd cried out, "Away with this man, release Barabbas for us." Pilate addressed them again, for he wanted Jesus to be the one he released. But they shouted back, "Crucify him, crucify him." He said to them for the third time, "What wrong is this man guilty of? I have not discovered anything about him deserving the death penalty. I will therefore chastise him and release him." But they demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done. He released the one they asked for, who had been thrown in prison for insurrection and murder, and delivered Jesus up to their wishes. A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him. Two others were crucified along with him. When they came to Skull Place, as it was called, they crucified him there and the criminals as well, one on his right and the other on his left. The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Messiah of God, the Chosen One." The soldiers also made fun of him, coming forward to offer him their sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was an inscription over his head, "This is the King of the Jews." Around midday, and darkness came over the whole land, until mid-afternoon with an eclipse of the sun. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After this, he expired. The centurion, upon seeing what had happened, gave glory to God by saying, "Surely this was the Son of God." After the crowd assembled for this spectacle witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
The sixth Sunday of Lent, which was formerly known as Palm Sunday, is now officially entitled Palm Sunday of the Passion of Christ. So runs its full title, showing, writes a liturgist, that the liturgy of the day will unite two commemorations, that of the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem and that of his Passion. The origin of Palm Sunday is explained in The Liturgical Year.
The diary of Egeria the Pilgrim tells us that at the beginning of the 5th century, the Christians of Jerusalem used to gather in the early afternoon on the Mount of Olives for a lengthy liturgy of the Word. Then, toward evening, they would go in procession into Jerusalem, carrying palm branches or olive branches. This rite was soon esteemed and imitated in other churches of the East. As for its spread in the West, the name Palm Sunday occurs in Spain and Gaul around 600, but there's no procession with the palms. In these countries, the Gospel for the Mass of the sixth Sunday of Lent was taken from John 12, which tells of the anointing at Bethany. But the passage continued on to the story of the entrance into Jerusalem. For this reason, the Sunday soon acquired the name of Palm Sunday, although there was as yet no special ceremony in commemoration of the event. The custom of blessing the palm branches is attested around the middle of the 8th century. Since palm and olive branches were obtainable only in southern countries, the custom was early introduced of blessing the green and blossoming branches of other trees, including beech branches. In Germany, it was usually branches of willows that already had their catkins.
And in medieval England, we hear, palms were often made from willow, box and yew. But willow is still used to this day. In Richard Mabie's Flora Britannica, we read, the Christian festival of Eastertide begins with Palm Sunday, when sprays of pussy willow or yew are sometimes used as substitutes for true palm. The pussy willow or sallow are vernacular names for the goat willow, the commonest and most widespread willows in Britain, and the earliest to flower. The catkins are put out before the leaves, silky, silver-grey buds. They used to be called goslings, writes Mabie, because their texture and colour were like newly hatched geese. And as children, we loved them. In his Prospect of Flowers, Andrew Young tells us that the sallow's catkins come a little later than those of the hazel, for, he writes,
the sallow, observant of the church's ritual, waits to provide palm for Palm Sunday. The sallow, or palm willow, grows anywhere, and early in March we may see in some sheltered spot, perhaps a hollow wood, as the first sign of spring, among willows at least, the satin shining palm. By the end of March these buds have opened, the catkins on the make, trees yellow with pollen. And through the leafless underwood, rich stains of sunny gold show where the sallows bloom.
So wrote John Clare in the early 19th century. And a 20th century comment seems to confirm the continuance of a long tradition.
I remember attending Sunday school on Palm Sunday and wearing a sprig of pussy willow, and my father was always told, you get your hair pulled if you don't wear a piece of palm on Palm Sunday.
But what was the significance of the palm? It gets its name from the Latin palma, palm of the hand, from the spread hand appearance of the tree. It's a symbol of resolution, overcoming calamity. It's said by Orientals to have sprung from the residue of the clay of which Adam was formed. But when someone talks about their palmy days, they're referring to prosperous or happy days, as those were to a victorious gladiator, to whom the Romans gave a branch of the palm tree as a reward for his prowess. From this too comes our expression to bear the palm, while to yield the palm of victory is to admit another's superiority in a given field. Here in Italy we have olive branches on Palm Sunday, and on that first Palm Sunday, the branches were of both palms and olives, for both trees grew in the area. In a poem by Robert Browning, The Patriot, its hero is greeted with roses and myrtle, which was sacred to Venus and a symbol of love. But the patriot of the poem is on his way to execution and is remembering with bitterness the acclamation of the populace a year earlier.
It was roses, roses all the way, with myrtle mixed in my path like mad. The house roofs seemed to heave and sway, the church spires flamed, such flags they had, a year ago on this very day. The air broke into a mist with bells, the old walls rocked with the crowd and cries. There's nobody on the housetops now, just a palsied few at the window set. For the best of the sight is all allow at the shambles' gate, or better yet, by the very scaffold's foot, I trow.
The shambles' gate was probably very near the place of execution, shambles originally meaning a stall in a market where meat was sold, and later meaning a slaughterhouse. Jesus had the crowds always, on his day of triumph and on that of his death. And a scholar makes this reflection on the shouts of Hosanna.
In the song of the crowd of disciples, there's almost an answer to the angelic greeting in the hymn for the birth of Christ. The angels sang, Glory to God in the highest and peace on earth to the men he loves. Now the disciples proclaim, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heavens.
And from the palms we come now to the Passion. Our Gospel today, in the short form, of which we've just heard a part, begins with the first words of chapter 23 of Luke's Gospel, with Jesus already being taken to Pilate. But the long version of the Gospel begins at the opening of the previous chapter, with the treason of Judas, the Last Supper, and the institution of the Eucharist. And then Jesus and the disciples go to the Mount of Olives, as usual, we read. Only when they get there, Jesus withdraws from them, after telling them to pray not to be put to the test. Luke writes that he was only about a stone's throw away, but it's as if he were thousands of miles away, totally alone. In all his life, he has never been so alone as at this moment. He prays for the cup to be taken from him, but then, nevertheless, let your will be done, not mine. In his poem, The Olive Garden, Rainer Maria Rilke imagines the agony of Jesus as he goes on, not just a little further, but upward.
And still he climbed, and through the grey leaves thrust, quite grey and lost in the grey olive lands, and laid his burning forehead full of dust, deep in the dustiness of burning hands. After all, this and this then was the end. Now I'm to go, while I'm going blind, and oh, why wilt thou have me still contend, thou art, whom I myself no longer find? No more I find thee, in myself no tone of thee, nor in the rest, nor in this stone. I can find thee no more. I am alone. I am alone with all that human fate I undertook through thee to mitigate. Thou who art not, O shame too consummate. An angel came, those afterwards relate. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night, and turned the leaves of trees indifferently, and the disciples stirred uneasily. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night.
The night came indeed, and with it Judas and arrest, interrogation by Annas, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, Peter's denial, cockcrow. What a night! Where did he spend it? With the guards, presumably, who had their sport with him, mocking him, beating him, blindfolding him, and asking him, "Who hit you?" Jesus of a certainty had no sleep that night. The guards on duty would have seen to that. And a line from a poem about a street vagrant comes to mind. Where did last night's Christ lie down? Day breaks, and the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, who have had a night's sleep, meet in council and have Jesus brought to them. Is he the Christ? Is he the Son of God? Is all they ask now. And his answer decides them. He must die. And so, to Pilate. Of the four evangelists, only John reports the dialogue between Jesus and Pilate in any length. But they all quote the question, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And the answer, "It is you who say it." Because this was the ultimate indictment, his claim to be king. The real reason for the Sanhedrin's sentence of death was his claim to be Son of God, but Pilate would not have understood the gravity which such a blasphemy had in their eyes. So the reason was given a political slant. As Pilate does not yield immediately, the chief priests add that Jesus has been stirring up the people with his teaching, from Galilee, where he began, to this very place. Galilee, Herod's territory. So Pilate sends him to Herod, who sends him back. Pilate then offers to release Jesus instead of Barabbas. But by now the crowd has become a howling mob, and there is no turning back.
They demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done.
And it was. And to close these reflections, Here are some lines from The Killing by Edwin Moore, said against the background of Luke's words. That was the day they killed the Son of God on a squat hilltop by Jerusalem. Zion was bare, her children from their maze sucked by the demon curiosity clean through the gates. The very halt and blind had somehow got themselves up the hill.
A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him.
After the ceremonial preparation, the scourging, nailing against the wood, erection of the main trees with their burden, while from the hill rose an orchestral wailing, they were there at last, high up in the soft spring day. We watched the writhings, heard the moanings, saw the three heads turning on their separate axles like broken wheels left spinning. Round his head was loosely bound a crown of plaited thorn that hurt at random, stinging temple and brow as the pain swung into its envious circle.
The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him. The soldiers also made fun of him.
Some who came to stare grew silent as they looked, indignant or sorry. But the hardened old and the hard-hearted young, although at odds from the first morning, cursed him with one curse, having prayed for a rabbi or an armed messiah, and found the Son of God. What use to them was a god or a son of God? Of what avail for purposes such as theirs? Beside the cross-foot, alone, four women stood and did not move all day. The sun revolved, the shadow wheeled.
And darkness came over the whole land. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After he said this, he expired.
Death was slow and came so quietly they scarce could mark it.
After the crowd assembled for this spectacle, witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
I was a stranger, could not read these people or this outlandish deity. Did a god indeed in dying cross my life that day by chance, he on his road and I on mine?
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for bringing us yet another There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. She brings us the Vatican Week in review. So, Joan, welcome back. We have a new Pope.
Oh,
Habemus Papam.
Habemus Papam, indeed.
And what a Pope.
I mean, is this show going to be an hour this week? Because, you know, it's like in an hour with Pope Francis, you only would begin to scratch the surface. We're finding a man very close to God in prayer and very close to people in deeds. So you have words and deeds, and he's living them out. And, you know, you look at Francis. He explained his name for the first time to the journalist when he met them in his first formal public meeting after meeting with the cardinals. And he also re-explained it Friday to the diplomatic corps, the twofold intention of choosing the name Francis, which, by the way, folks, he chose right then and there in the conclave. He was sitting next to, and he said, told the story. He was sitting next to Brazilian Cardinal Claudio James, and when they both could see that the numbers were going up and it was obvious that Cardinal Bergoglio was going to be the next pope, Cardinal James leaned over to his friend of many years and said, "Don't forget the poor." And it was in that moment that Cardinal Bergoglio decided on the name Francis.
Which is interesting because he's a Jesuit.
But a man who, as he did explain in his name, who loves very much St. Francis, who's lived his own life as Archbishop of Buenos Aires and even before, in a sense of poverty, had a very simple apartment. There was no fancy car. He rode the buses. He lived his existence as many other people did. He didn't have people at his beck and call. Certainly, he had a staff at the Curia. He will have a staff here in Rome. But he's living out his life as Holy Father as he did it then, the humility, the humanity. And we've even seen a very good sense of humor. And, for example, going back to the early days or hours of his pontificate, he rode the little minibus back to the Santa Marta residence where the cardinals had been staying from the Sistine Chapel. And I saw one picture somebody took, and it's all the little red zucchettos and then this little white zucchetto right in the midst. He goes down to the dining room and picks out his own tray and looks around the dining room for a place to sit. So he's, you know, enjoying being with the cardinals that way. But my favorite picture, certainly of the first month of his pontificate, is going to be the one where he goes to the Casa del Clero, the clerical prelate residency for prelates visiting Rome. And here he is, dressed in white. He is now the new Holy Father, Pope Francis, and he's at the front desk paying his bill. And, of course, I'm surprised they let him pay his bill. I wouldn't have charged the man myself, I don't think.
Well, maybe they didn't.
We never truly knew that. So his gestures already, and then the biggest gesture for Holy Week, for heaven's sakes, that was just announced this week, that the Mass of the Lord's Supper, which is normally held in St. John Lateran Basilica, and a couple times Benedict held it in St. Peter's, that is going to be at a youth detention center on the periphery of Rome. And the wonderful thing about that is, I mean, this totally reflects his love for the poor, the sick, the underprivileged, the homeless. And I think what's wonderful is that we already know now there's probably going to be only Vatican television, Vatican radio, maybe a pool of two or three photographers, which is exactly as it should be for that kind of a mass. That this is a very important liturgical event, but also will be a very important personal moment, not only for the Holy Father, but for everyone at that center. So we're seeing great, great evidence of a man who has lived poverty, who said that's why he chose the name Francis, because of Francis's love for the poor. But he also noted that St. Francis was a builder, a seeker of peace. And that's what we'll see in just a minute, looking at some of our notes. That's what he told the diplomatic corps on Friday. Here are the two reasons I chose my name: St. Francis's love for the poor and his desire to build peace. There's just so many signals that Pope Francis is giving out. For example, he this week met the leaders of religions, Christian and non. Patriarch Bartholomew, the ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, came and spoke in the name of the other leaders present. And this was the first time since the Great Schism of 1054 that a patriarch had come for, not the first time in Rome, but had come for the inauguration of a pontificate. So huge history there. But what is more interesting, with the Orthodox, it must be understood that, for example, for Bartholomew, leader of the Orthodox, well, in name only, because there's autocephalous, there's independent Orthodox churches. They don't have a single leader like the Roman Catholic Church does. But for the Orthodox, the patriarch is the descendant of St. Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, and they believe that God gave the duty to build his church and the keys to the kingdom to Andrew. Whereas, of course, we Catholics believe that St. Peter was given Peter the rock upon whom I'll build my church. So it was very significant for Pope Francis to address Bartholomew as my brother Andrew. Francis, though, John Paul and Francis did to go into crowds. And we saw that Sunday at the Mass when he celebrated Mass in the parish church of St. Anne's in the Vatican. Teensy little church, can't seat many people. A lot of us go there, you know, for daily Mass. It's very beautiful, been around since the 16th century. And so he went there just as a normal parish priest. And what I loved afterwards, as people poured out of the church, there he was, the Holy Father, greeting them, hugging them, you know, caressing little children. But as the people kept pouring out, I said to someone, I was doing a television commentary at the time, and I said to someone, you know, I think they're opening the back door to the church and letting people in, because it seemed like more were greeting him than were there for Mass. And then he turns around, and St. Anna Gate is like 12 feet away, and then you're in the city of Rome. And he just, you know, wanders out into the streets of the city of Rome to meet people.
We had the inauguration mass of the Petrine Ministry on Tuesday. That was in St. Peter's Square.
An amazing mass and an amazing homily. The words that have come up in his homilies, he spoke a great deal because of the number of, there were 132 delegations, world leaders, religious leaders, civil and religious. He stressed his own ministry. He said, my own ministry is not one of power. It is one of service. And he said that authentic authority is service. He stressed the words Sunday at the Angelus and at the Mass in St. Anne's of mercy, of divine mercy. God is always there. He loves us in a way that none of us can understand. And he never tires of loving us. We should never tire of asking for his love and his mercy. At his Mass Tuesday, because it was the Feast of St. Joseph, he highlighted St. Joseph's own ministry to be the protector of Jesus, the protector of Mary, a man of great humility and of service. Pope Francis talked about protecting creation, which is not only nature, God's creation. It is his most beautiful creature, and that is man. And again, Pope Francis stressed helping the poor, helping the old, helping the young, the unprotected, and those who are defenseless. And I think it behooves us really to underline one or two things he said to the diplomatic corps whom he received on Friday. He said, through you, the ambassadors, he said, I can, in a sense, reach out to every one of your fellow citizens, their joys, troubles, expectations, and desires. What matters most to the Holy See is the good of every person on this earth. And by the way, he kept referring to himself, as you and I know he has done, as the Bishop of Rome. He does not refer to his title of Holy Father or I, Pope, Bishop of Rome. And he said he also hopes there's an opportunity to begin a journey with the countries that don't have diplomatic relations with the Holy See, but some of whom were present at the Mass for the beginning of his ministry. And then the Holy Father did go into explaining his name. We've gone over that, his reasons for choosing Francis. He said one of the titles of the Bishop of Rome is Pontiff, a builder of bridges. It is not possible to build bridges between people while forgetting God. But the converse is also true. It's not possible to establish true links with God while ignoring other people. And then he talked about dialogue, not only with countries, but with religions, and placed particular emphasis on Islam. I thought that was very interesting. So in his closing remarks to the diplomats, he said, fighting poverty, again, poverty, a theme of his pontificate, fighting poverty, both material and spiritual, building peace and constructing bridges. These, as it were, are the reference points for a journey I want to invite each of the countries here represented to take up. He said, it's a difficult journey. He knows that. He's not saying something that is going to be easy to accomplish, but he has to say it. So he's Holy Father, and I'm fascinated by the emphasis on the Bishop of Rome.
Well, we'll wait and see, won't we?
Next week, more stories and probably more little forays into the unknown and unscripted with Pope Francis.
Thank you very much, Joan.
Bless.
And you were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, while we won't be back again at the same time tomorrow, we will be back again at the same time next weekend. So be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.